On this episode of Pilot's Discretion, we're joined by spin instructor and AOPA pilot writer, Catherine Cavagnaro. She talks about the right way to use flaps, setting personal minimums, and teaching both flying and math. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, John Zimmerman of Sporties. Remember to visit sporties.com/podcast for all of today's show links and for access to every episode of Pilot's Discretion. You can also email us if you have comments or guest ideas, podcast@sporties.com. Today, I'm joined by flight instructor and writer Catherine Cavagnaro. She is an ATP, flight instructor, and designated pilot examiner, and she teaches at Ace Aerobatic School in Suwanee, Tennessee, specializing in spins and aerobatic training. When she's not flying, she is a professor of mathematics at the University of the South in Suwanee, and she's a regular contributor to AOPA Pilot Magazine. She was also named the 2020 Flight Instructor of the Year and was recently inducted into the Flight Instructor Hall of Fame. Catherine, congratulations and welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as an ATP and a math PhD, you bring a technical perspective, I think, to a lot of your writing about training and airmanship, which I find very interesting. So let's talk about a couple of topics in aerodynamics. You recently wrote about the region of reverse command, sometimes called the backside of the power curve. And I find this topic to be one of the most misunderstood in all of aviation. So can you give us a simple explanation for what it really means?
Sure. So for airspeeds that are greater than VY, which is our best rate of climb airspeed, the controls are pretty predictable. For example, let's talk about an aircraft that, say, experiences some sort of departure from cruise altitude. If the airplane, for example, is suddenly thrust upward by a gust, well, to get back down to our cruise altitude, we have a choice as pilots. Either I can reduce the throttle, in which case the aircraft is going to naturally descend back to my cruise altitude. So that would be one way of rectifying that error. Another is that I can just push forward on the control yoke and descend back to altitude. I'll pick up a little airspeed, but once I get back to my assigned altitude, then, you know, ultimately the airspeed will stabilize back to the setting that I had before, assuming that the power is set the same way. All right. So I have my choice on the front side of the power curve. So that's very predictable. Now on the back side of the power curve, let's suppose that I'm flying at a slower airspeed. So I'm flying at, minimal controllable airspeed or maybe an airspeed that I might use in the pattern, which is typically slower than VY, say, as I approach down toward the runway. If I have a gust of wind that takes me above my descent profile to the pattern, then if I retard the throttle, just like on the front side of the power curve, I'm going to naturally settle back down to my proper descent profile or my whatever my altitude might be. Now, what's interesting, though, is if I want to correct that using pitch control alone, then what would I do on the back side of the power curve? On the front side of the power curve, we would push forward. And what would happen is we would settle back down to our cruise altitude. But if we are at an airspeed that is below VY, then if I push forward on the control, then what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to increase my altitude. So it's going to have the opposite effect. So what I should do if I'm just bound and determined to make that correction using pitch control alone is I would pull back on the control yoke. Well, you can imagine there could be a problem there. If I am flying at minimal controllable airspeed already and I pull back on the yoke, then I would be more likely to induce a stall, which of course is not what we want to do in the pattern until we're right over the runway, just a few feet above. So that's why it is so important on the backside of the power curve to use pitch to control our airspeed, and then power is going to control either our altitude or our proper descent profile. So I like to use that that way of managing the airplane actually all the way down from, you know, if I'm descending toward an airport, I'm typically pitching for an airspeed as I approach that airport, even before I get in the pattern. So that's what really distinguishes the front side of the power curve from the back side of the power curve. The front side of the power curve, you have a natural choice. The back side of the power curve, it's really safe to use pitch to control airspeed and power to control your altitude or descent profile.
That's a great explanation. I love your use of VY. Sometimes people make it very mysterious about when am I there? How do I know I'm there? And in VY, I think most people have committed to memory, so it's a good way to think about it. It makes me wonder, though, you know, a lot of times we talk about the base to final turn. We talk about final approach, pitch for airspeed, power for altitude, that whole debate. Is this also a consideration on takeoff? Because something AOPA has done, and I think a nice job in recent years of highlighting, is that many loss of control and stall accidents happen on a go around or takeoff. So I assume, while I might have full power here, it's at least something I should be thinking about on a takeoff as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's true. My understanding is that for all the press and attention that the base to final stall spin scenario has, and there's no, you know, that is certainly a serious flight situation, and I don't mean to diminish that at all, but there are more problems that occur on either the takeoff or the go-around scenario where we might be trimmed for a pretty high angle of attack. You know, I use pretty aggressive trim inputs as I approach for a landing. But what that means is when I am giving full throttle, as I routinely do on go-arounds, I need to pay very close attention to making sure that I am nailing the precise airspeed that I want with my pitch control.
Another interesting topic you've discussed relates a little bit to that go-around scenario, specifically flaps, which I think most pilots probably think they understand. I put the flaps down, I slow down. But you have said in some articles, you should be pushing forward on the yoke when we raise flaps, especially after a takeoff or a go-around. Why is that?
Right. So the lift that is created by an airplane is proportional to the absolute angle of attack, or coefficient of lift, if you prefer. And it's also proportional to the square of velocity. So let's put ourselves in a situation where we have taken off with flaps, which is common for, say, a short field technique, or some aircraft like the Diamond DA-40 advocate departing with flaps for all takeoffs. But we've just taken off, we're several hundred feet above the ground, and now it comes time to retract our flaps. Now, what's going to happen when you retract your flaps is you will get a loss of lift that occurs from retracting the flaps. So what'll happen is the aircraft will initially descend toward the ground or accelerate toward the ground. And that can be kind of a dangerous situation, because it's often the case that when we feel ourselves either going toward the ground or accelerating toward the ground, we have a natural reaction to pull back on the yoke. And that would be the worst thing in that situation, because then you're going to further reduce the lift created by the aircraft. So what you really should be doing to smooth out that technique, because, you know, that acceleration toward the ground just feels, honestly, to me, it feels creepy. And I feel it a lot when folks retract flaps without paying attention to the fact that they should be, you know, lowering the nose to pick up additional airspeed to compensate for the lack of lift that they're getting by retracting the flaps. So at best, that's avoiding an uncomfortable feeling for passengers. But at worst, you know, this is a safety issue as well. In one of my articles, I highlighted an unfortunate accident that happened in a Cirrus that was approaching an airport in Texas. And long story short, there were a sequence of go-around attempts. And on each subsequent attempt, the airspeed at which she retracted the flaps kept getting lower and lower. And it was so dangerously low that in the last go-around, when she gave it full power and retracted the flaps, it ended up in a stall spin scenario, and three people were killed when they impacted the ground.
Now, flaps on takeoff is one thing. Flaps, how about on a power off 180? I thought this was fascinating. You talk about using flaps and a little bit of the flaps flaps slips debate here. So if I'm doing a power off 180, when should I use flaps?
Okay, so power off 180 is one of my favorite maneuvers because to me, it involves the pilot having an intimate knowledge of the gliding capabilities of the aircraft and also the drag effects of various devices like flaps or the introduction of a slip. So one of my pet peeves is when the power is retracted, abeam the touchdown point, I see folks immediately add flaps. And the deal with the power off 180 is because of changing atmospheric conditions, no two of those will ever be the same. So to me, it's always having something in your back pocket. You're either able to add a bit of drag or maybe take a bit of drag away so that you can hit your spot with changing winds as you descend toward the runway. So one of my pet peeves is adding flaps right away, which some people think that adding, say, that first notch is going to give you extra lift. And that's true, but it also introduces a lot of drag. And what's inefficient or maybe inflexible about adding flaps is taking them back out is, you end up getting that sort of sinking that you really don't need. I think a slip is a much more flexible way to manage your descent profile toward the runway. So I like to save flaps for short final and in a power off 180. I think a big mistake that people make is they just add them too soon.
Yeah, I've had that feeling. I remember early on in maybe commercial training, turning base and feeling really high and starting to panic a little bit, and you put the flaps in and then you turn final and realize that 15 knot tailwind on downwind is now a 15 knot headwind. And all of a sudden you're not feeling so high anymore. And I had a flight instructor show me a slip that essentially proved it's really hard to be too high on final in an engine failure scenario for real. You really can slip your way out of trouble a lot easier than you can create lift and fix a problem of being too low.
Absolutely. And I routinely slip. I'm a big fan of high approaches. My home airport is short, it's narrow, it often has some crazy winds, and it's surrounded by really tall trees. And the reason I'm actually speaking with you today is, again, I'm a fan of high approaches. I had an aircraft years ago that had an engine that let me down on final, and the reason that I made the runway so easily is that I had the extra altitude and gliding to the runway was just a non-issue. So I'm a big fan of those high, steep approaches, and you can lose a lot of altitude slipping and still maintaining a responsible airspeed so that when you touch down, you can dissipate that energy effectively and efficiently.
Catherine, let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to talk to you about check rides.
Earn your pilot's license. Get current or add a rating. No matter what your goal is, Sporty's pilot training app will save you time and money. It's available on all your devices, including iPad, iPhone, Android, and smart TVs, so you can access Sporty's award-winning courses anywhere. Plus, with up-to-date sync between platforms and free lifetime updates, you'll always be up to date. Over 25 courses are available, from private pilot to aerobatics. Visit sporties.com/discover for a free trial. Now, back to pilot's discretion.
We're back with Catherine Cavinero, and you're a pilot examiner. You do a lot of check rides in the Tennessee area there. So I have some questions on check rides, a real stressful event for a lot of pilots in their career, especially early on. I've heard it said before that most examiners have a pretty good idea if the applicant will pass in the first 5 minutes. You can just sort of get a read for how they approach flying. You agree or disagree with that statement?
Gosh, that's a great question. I would tend to disagree with that statement. And, you know, we're all nervous in FAA exams. I've taken 11 FAA check rides. I was nervous 11 of those check rides. So it's just, it's the nature of the beast. You know, we care about it. It's something that means a lot to us. So, you know, there's a lot riding on that day. And so we're nervous. So I am, you know, compassionate with folks who are nervous. And there are times when I see somebody who's so nervous, and I try to put people at ease because I need to tell the difference between, you know, are these nerves talking that are giving me these strange answers? Or is there a fundamental shortcoming that needs to be addressed before this person can be certificated? And if the person is nervous, sometimes it can be hard to tell the difference. I'll give an example for an instrument practical exam that I gave a few years ago. And I could tell this young man was so incredibly nervous. And I know that he had failed his practical exam for the private on the very first question. And so he was even more nervous as he approached his instrument practical exam. And right off the bat, the first question I asked was just this preposterous answer. And I thought to myself, oof, this is not going to be a fun day. But I thought, okay, you know what? I'm just going to move away from this topic and we'll circle back to it later. So I tried to put him at ease and we covered some other topics. And then a little later, I just circled back to that first area and he nailed it. And for him, that was nerves. And by the way, he passed his instrument practical exam that day. So I would say that there are a lot of times where I see it not going in a good direction and it doesn't turn around. But I have been surprised on occasion. So I usually try to reserve judgment until much later in the exam. And I make sure that I never stop the exam after a question or two. We talk a fair amount because, you know, you really want to get a sense for, you know, is this nerve stalking or is there a shortcoming that needs to be addressed? And it's not the end of the world if it's the latter.
How about the I don't know response? I think many applicants are just panicked about getting the question where you just brain freezes and you don't know. Is it okay to say, I don't know, but I can look it up? What do you want to hear in a situation?
That's a great question. And something that I tell all applicants before we start is that I like to think of practical exams as closed book exams. But if on occasion you'd like to consult an appropriate reference, that's totally fine. We all need to consult an appropriate reference, myself included, on occasion. And actually, sometimes I like to hear I don't know, because here are examples of two folks where I hear I don't know, and there's a complete different result in the practical exam. There are some people who say, I don't know, may I look that up? And sure, so they get out, you know, part 91, they flip through it for a minute or two, they find the resource, and then they give me the answer. And that is valuable information. That person knows where to look. And the person B maybe takes out part 23 or maybe part 61, has no idea where to look. And those are two different outcomes to the practical exam, because at the end of the day, we all don't know everything, but the ability to be resourceful in a specific situation in flying, that's what I want to see. So to me, it's actually valuable sometimes to hear, I don't know, because then that gives me the extra information of knowing, does this person know where to look? Can this person find what he or she needs to know in an anomalous situation out there flying? Because you know what? They happen to all of us.
What task do you see applicants struggle with most often? If somebody's going for a private pilot check ride next week, what's an area you would urge them to focus on?
So there are a number of areas where I see shortcomings. One of them that's really disappointing to me is the lack of ability for some to secure a standard briefing for the flight. And I call it a standard briefing instead of a weather briefing because it's more than just weather. It's, you know, TFRs and NOTAMs and things like that. So that's something that's really, I confess, one of something that disappoints me.
Let's talk about personal minimums, an idea that has been promoted by the FAA and the safety industry in general for a long time. But I confess, I'm a little skeptical. So I'd like you to sell me on it if you can. Because my view is, in rough terms, Mother Nature doesn't know what my personal minimums are. So if I have an instrument rating, don't I need to be able to fly an approach to 200 and a half if I need to?
Right. Yeah. So I have some definite ideas on personal minimums. And part of those have evolved from what I see on practical exam situations where I see that some candidates haven't assembled any sort of personal minimums. And the fact is, your personal minimums are going to differ from mine. Even mine change over time. For example, if I haven't had the recent instrument experience that I would like to have, my personal minimums in terms of instruments are going to become more conservative, where if I've done more lately, they're going to naturally expand. One situation that I had about a year and a half ago that really got me thinking more about personal minimums is a call I received from a pilot in Georgia, and he let me know about an accident that had happened at the Gainesville Airport. And long story short, the pilot had taken off in a new-to-him airplane with a new-to-him panel with a newly earned instrument rating. He took off at night in low IFR with family on board. There were also some mechanical problems with the plane. And just putting all of those together, how many yellow and red flags do we need to see before we put the plane back in the hangar? And it was, you know, so three people died in that accident, and it was just, it was so unnecessary. And one of the reasons that it hit home to me was I had given him his private pilot exam, and I stared at that ceiling many nights wondering, were there some hazardous attitudes that I missed when I saw him that day? I don't know where he got his instrument rating, but still, you know, I wondered, were there some attitudes that I missed? You know, I always talk about personal minimums because I think it's important to assemble a set of personal minimums that makes sense. For example, for me, I routinely get a lot of crosswind practice because my airport dishes it up. It keeps even base pilots humble at my airport. But like I say, sometimes my IFR minimums, especially since COVID, I haven't traveled as much as I used to or I would like to. So those have certainly become more conservative. But I'd like to think that after I see all of those yellow and red flags line up, that I would put the plane back in the hangar. So it just got me thinking and about personal minimums. And I always discuss personal minimums in practical exams, but I do even more so after that accident. So personal minimums, I think, are actually important.
And how about what goes into a personal minimums list? I know we often talk about weather, but it strikes me that there's more to it than just weather. There's pilot readiness, there's rest, there's all kinds of other elements. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, you can run through the I'm safe checklist. That's a good place to sort of pre-flight the pilot. You know, things like illness, medication, you know, stress, alcohol. And of course, you know, it's easy to know, gosh, did I have a drink last night or did I not have a drink last night? That's easy, right? But fatigue, I think, is the one that is really insidious because the effects of fatigue can be a lot like intoxication. But it's harder for me every day to judge, did I have a great night's sleep last night, or was it just okay, or was it poor? You know, that can be all over the map. So that's one that I think is really hard to assess. There was an accident. I think it was a cargo carrier into Birmingham a few years ago. And I think the conditions were good VFR, but it was early in the morning. I think it was something like 5 a.m. And the pilot and co-pilot just drove the plane into the ground short of the runway. And I think fatigue was cited as a probable cause for that accident. So you're right. It is so much more than just, weather minimums. And for me, the addition of friends and family will also make my minimums more conservative, because I know that they are a source of distraction. As much as I love my children, they have been a big distraction over the years. They're a joy to fly with, but they're a distraction. And sometimes just knowing that there are other people on board that are relying on me makes me a little more keyed up. So I tend to have more conservative personal minimums when I have other people on board.
Catherine, we like to close Pilot's Discretion episodes with a segment we call Ready to Copy. I'll ask some questions on a wide range of topics, and you give me a quick answer. Are you ready to copy?
I think so.
You got to learn spins and aerobatics from the great Bill Kirshner, one of my aviation heroes when I was a young pilot. What's something he taught you that most instructors wouldn't normally teach?
So in terms of teaching aerobatics, he taught me the wisdom of not only having a six sack on board, but it's not enough to have it on board or to even make sure that it's pulled out of the wrapper if you haven't pre-blown air into that six sack so that it can be at the ready in an instant, then you haven't done your job.
That is a fantastic tip. My gosh, that is gold. Thank you. Here's a topic that gets debated on bar stools occasionally. Should spins be required for the private pilot check ride?
At this point, unfortunately, no. And the reason that, even though I think every pilot should avail him or herself of some good stall and spin training, instructors these days they're just not equipped to properly teach spins. So I wish I could say the answer is yes, but it's no.
What's a seemingly silly training maneuver that is actually valuable?
I think the turnaround a point is a valuable maneuver because it has you maneuvering close to the ground, adjusting for winds, making sure that, say, your pilot who might be, say, taking photos of something on the ground has a good line of sight. You're a distracted pilot. You are looking around for other traffic. And let's face it, when we take people flying, what do they want to do? They want to go see their house, or they want to go see something interesting on the ground. So I think a turnaround a point is sort of an underrated maneuver.
How about overrated? What's something we spend too much time on and isn't worth it?
Eights on pylons. So actually, as a mathematician, it's one of my favorite maneuvers to sort of dissect, but I don't really see the purpose. My own feeling is that I rarely see great eight on pylons demonstrated on a practical exam. I get it. It's one of those maneuvers where you are focused on a point on the ground. You're a busy pilot. You have to maintain a constant line of sight with a pylon on the ground. You are also making sure that your passenger has a comfortable experience, and you are looking around for other terrain and traffic. So I get why it's required for the commercial exam and also the flight instructor exam for that reason, but truthfully, I've rarely seen a great one, and honestly, most pilots don't really understand them.
Should all pilots read Stick and Rudder, or is it out of date now and overrated?
No, I think it is not out of date. It is not overrated. I think it's a great text, and I think it should be part of every pilot's library.
Do you have to be good at math to be a good pilot on some basic level? Maybe not a PhD, but does it help to be good at math, or is that not really needed anymore?
I don't don't think it's necessary. I personally delight in the combination of mathematics and aviation. Mathematics gives me a lens through which I can better understand aviation. So when I give presentations for, you know, FAA, for AOPA and such, I try to introduce some of the mathematics that I think is helpful to pilots. I try to make that understandable and accessible through videos that I make that makes the aerodynamics, say, come alive and be interesting. But I find that mathematics does help me understand aviation on a deeper level. So I personally appreciate it. I'm not necessarily sure that it is vital for all pilots.
How about the other way around? Does teaching flying make you a better math professor?
Absolutely. So my students at the university love it when I introduce airplane examples. In fact, a year ago, I taught a class at the university that was basically the mathematics of flight. And that was a lot of fun. So I took all of my math students flying and they absolutely loved it. So, you know, mathematics is a wonderful area of study. And I think when you can show math students that some of this math matters, right? Sometimes we study mathematics just because it's beautiful in its own right, but there's a beauty to the application as well. So I'm a big fan of introducing mathematics students to the world of aviation.
Can you describe geometric topology in 10 words or less?
let's see. So geometric topology is the study of, I'm probably going to go beyond 10 words. So geometric topology is the study of abstract spaces and continuous transformations on them. I'm not sure if I got that in 10.
I'm going to leave it at that because it's way over my head. Our last question is always the same, yep. Catherine. You have one final flight, and our question is, what are you flying and where are you going?
I am flying with my two boys in my Bonanza Nikki, and we're going to do something amazing and see an amazing sight in this country, and I'm going to share that with them.
Catherine, thanks for being on the podcast.
John, this is so much fun. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and links to additional information, visit sporties.com/podcast. And if you have comments or guest ideas, email us at podcast@sporties.com. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.